history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really need to be told, and we're going to miss out. We're never going to hear them unless we take a little time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And boy, when we take off on that journey, we end up learning a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And the gentleman we're going to meet today is a part of that generation, 91-year-old John Durant of Fresno, California, originally from the Boston, Massachusetts area. We're going to hear a lot about the Berlin Airlift today because it's the 70th anniversary. It was a year-long effort, but it's the 70th anniversary right about now, and we'll tell you about some other events taking place. But I'm curious, John, how often you run into someone who's never heard of the Berlin Airlift, who doesn't know what it is?
Quite often. Young people never heard of it. It's not in the history books in school, and unless they've heard from one of their older parents or relatives, they don't even know what it is.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to hear how you relate it to young people and explain it to people who have never heard of it before. But it was a pretty significant event, wasn't it?
We didn't know it because we were there doing a job. We didn't know we were making history.
Have you ever wondered how different the world would be today if the airlift had never taken place?
Incredibly different. Incredibly different. So many things came out of that airlift. So many aviation advances took place because of that. The free world came alive because of that. Up until that time, we had the Cold War, and when the airlift started, Harry Truman, one of my heroes of my lifetime, Harry Truman said, "We're not going to let them guys get us out of Berlin. We're going to fly this stuff in." So he called Clay, General Clay, who was in charge of a European theater. Clay called LeMay, General LeMay. He said, "LeMay, can you fly stuff into Berlin? How much? What do you need?" "Well, we need coal, and we can fly coal." We started out with 102 C-47s, 30 of which were down for maintenance, 30 of which were assigned to generals as their private air taxi, and 30 of which we had. Well, for 30 DC-3s, you can't do too much. So Truman got a hold of 25 C-54s, the four-engine job, carries 10 tons, and flew them over there. And within a few months, we had about 380 C-54s. They all came out of MATS, Military Air Transport Service. And mm-hmm. MATS hated our guts because we took half their airplanes.
You stole all their planes.
And not only that, we stole their leader. We stole Tunner. Up until that time, we had a guy that was a former fighter pilot in charge, but he didn't really know how to organize something of this magnitude. But Tunner knew what to do. He had us right down to the wire.
Well, I want to come back to that and get the whole picture of the Berlin Airlift, how you experienced it, and why it still matters today. Let's learn a little more about John Durant, because you're 91 now, but take me back 80 years or so to that boy growing up in Boston. What were you all about?
Crazy about model airplanes, okay?
Yeah.
Crazy about model airplanes. I joined the Boy Scouts. The first thing that we did is go out to the field in the rain and build a tent and build a fire and stay overnight. I said, "This is not for me." I got a bed. So I quit the Boy Scouts and got involved in model airplanes, and also got involved in radio. I was a radio ham for a while. Mm-hmm. Did that too. And then 17 came along, joined the Air Force. Had no teenage years. Teenage years were gone. You know, I tell these kids when I teach them now, "How old are you?" 16 and a half. When 17, I was over there fighting Italy, you know. He's just a kid. And I didn't know I was a kid. You know, you go over there, you get thrown into a job, you do a man's job overnight. You turn from a teenager into a man. And I got tossed out in the hangar working on airplanes and worked till midnight most nights. And that was part of the job. You just did what you had to do.
Well, and so many millions of Americans were in similar circumstances. But just a couple things come to mind. First of all, you're a kid in Boston in the heyday of the Splendid Splinter. Of Ted Williams.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Were you sneaking into games to watch
sure,
him swing it?
Sure. Oh, yeah. We managed to get to Fenway Park occasionally. That was incredible.
And he, like you, would go on to serve in World War II and, of course,
yeah,
was a decorated pilot.
Oh, yeah.
And you became a pilot at age 16?
I sold it at 16, yeah. Well, see, what we did, well, you hung around the airport. You got to make friends with all the pilots. Come on up, I'll give you a flight. I'll give you a lesson. I'll teach you how to do this. There were no instructors. They were all off in the military teaching pilots. So your friends taught you how to fly. And when they figured you were ready, they soloed you. They wrote a note. You went up to CAA up in Concord, New Hampshire, and got your license. I still got the license and flew quite a bit around there. The deal was at that time, if I can digress for a moment, we were within 50 miles of the coast. At that time, you could only fly 3 miles from the airport and up to 2,500 feet. So all you do is round and round and round and round and round. And that's how I learned to fly. You went around, you landed, you went around again and landed, went around again and landed, went around again. There was no lights, there was no radio, there was no extra mag, okay, one mag on a plane. So you didn't have a mag, Jack. If it ran, you took off. And after about 2.5 hours, nobody believes this, after about 2.5 hours, the guy says, hey, take it. So I took off and soloed at 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Now, normally you solo at 20 hours.
Yeah. Okay?
But here I've been building model airplanes for like 10 years. I knew what was there. I knew how things worked. It was a matter of just getting the feel for stuff. And the Piper Cub is easy. Anybody can fly it. And that was amazing. But the problem is later on in life, I didn't have time. I was too busy working around the world launching missiles with NASA. There was no place to lie anybody.
Well, I know you're making up for it now. You're still involved in aviation with the EAA and the Aero Club. But what was it that first lit that flame, that first gave you that aviation
bug? Buck Rogers.
Buck Rogers.
Buck Rogers. In the newspaper every day was Buck Rogers, the All-American boys, and then with Jack Armstrong, there was a few more. Oh, that lit the fire on me immediately.
<Yeah. laughs> I could see how that would do it. And what was that first plane that you soloed in at age 16?
J-3 Cub.
Uh-huh.
They're still flying around here. There's a lot of them around. They're nice to fly. They're easy.
Well, and something happened before that, if I have my math correctly, because you're 91 now, you weren't quite 16 yet when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, big day.
How'd you find out?
That's an interesting story. We were building a radio-controlled model airplane.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of us. Now, I wasn't doing it alone. A bunch of us. 9-foot wingspan. It carried 5.5 pounds of radio gear to move the rudder back and forth. That's it. And we had the radios going and checked out for 2.5, 3, 4 miles. We had the plane flying, so it would climb in one direction and glide another one. So we put it together. We headed out to a flying field on a cold December windy morning. Stood out there till noontime to decide, you know, if we fly this thing, we'll crack it up. Let's pack it up. So we went back to some kid's ham shack, got on the air. 4:30 that afternoon, the word flashed around the world, Pearl Harbor. Okay, we didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was. Our parents said, where's Pearl Harbor? Well, they told us in Hawaii. And anyway, the next day they took the ham bands away from us, and that was the end of that. The plane never flew again. Dumb me, I sold the engine. I should have kept the engine. The plane just ultimately fell apart. That was the end of that.
So you were flying a drone on December 7th, 1941.
Yeah, a drone, yeah. We didn't know it was a drone. It never flew that day. It flew before without the radio. We were testing it, flight testing. It flew well, fine, but it never flew again. Pearl Harbor, that was a big day. See, I was a freshman in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And during high school, you know, all my older, I was the youngest kid in high school. All the old my friends were going to the service, you know. They'd send us postcards from Edwards Air Force Base. Oh, wow, California, you know.
So you saw life changed significantly in the years that followed.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
And were you already thinking that at some point it was going to be your turn to join this effort?
I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait. So 17, let's go. I'm gone.
So what? How did that progress from there? Once you enlisted, what did they do with you?
Went to Biloxi, Mississippi for 1 month basic training and then shipped overseas as rapidly. They wanted us over there as quick as they could get us there. We went over there. I got over there in October of 1944 and got tossed into the hangar, you know, changed spark plugs till midnight. That's what we did. And we were flying in support of the Battle of the Bulge about that time. That started on December 16th. 16th. As history tells us, it was cloudy that day. We couldn't fly. It was cloudy the next day, and then after that, and then after that. The 23rd of December, the skies opened up. We put 850 airplanes in the air from our airfield alone, and the Germans just left all their vehicles and ran back through the woods to home. That was the end of that. The Belgians got all those vehicles together, got their barns together, and made museums. I've been all over Belgium. There's gorgeous museums all over to the Berlin area, especially in Bastogne. Bastogne will knock you out. There's three museums there that'll make our museum look sick. It's amazing. Unbelievable. Put that on your list. Go to Bastogne somewhere.
I'm dying to get there. My grandfather was there in Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge.
Really?
And they have a photo that he took of Patton on display in one of those museums there
no
in Bastogne.
No kidding. Oh, my God. You got to go there.
I do. One of these days. You want to fly me?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
we'll leave tomorrow.
Yeah, take some fuel. So where were you stationed over there?
Charleville, France.
Uh-huh.
On the Meuse River.
You say changing spark plugs. What kind of planes are you working on?
P-47s and P-51s. The P-47 had a radial. You had to get on a ladder, and you were upside down and up on top. That was a terrible job.
Yeah, the P-51 had that Rolls-Royce Merlin engine.
Yeah,
the P-47
right, yeah.
had the radial engine.
The Pratt & Whitney 2800.
Yeah. And you worked on both of them?
Well, I worked on both of them, yeah.
So all those fighter pilots who were flying strafing, bombing missions, escort missions, they were all dependent on you to keep their planes flying.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Well, I wasn't the only one. There was a whole bunch of us. You know, I did the spark plugs.
Uh-huh.
That's all I did, spark plugs. See, I was a brand-new kid, you know. I was the youngest kid in the bunch. And you do the spark plugs. That was the grunt job. Later on, I just started working on everything else, but started out with a grunt job.
And were those long days? Was that a tough job, an easy job?
Oh, that was long days. Well, that was half the night, yeah. They'd get back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We worked till midnight getting them ready for the next morning. Oh, yeah. Pilots were a lot of good friends. They were fantastic people. They were unbelievable. They were really nice to us.
Yeah, a lot of guys talk about there's a welcome to the war moment. There's a revelation or experience that, wow, this is real. The stakes are high. Did you see or feel or experience something like that over there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. We knew why we were there. War was still on. We knew why we were there. We landed at Calais, France, and we rode a rickety railroad for 5 days to get to where we were going and got off. And we're welcomed. You know, they gave us a great welcome. We were young kids. We were coming to help, and they tossed us in the mix right away.
Was there ever a concern that your base there could be attacked? Could be bombed?
We were bombed. We weren't shot. I was never shot at. I was bombed at. We were bombed at a couple of times. But we weren't concerned. It was not going to happen to us. You're a young kid. It's not going to happen to you. It's going to happen to him.
So then when you hear the siren go off and you know there's somebody coming in and you are a target, what do you do?
You go dive for a hole. we had holes dug all over the place. You dive for a hole. If the bomb's going to go off, it's going to spread shrapnel everywhere. If you're standing there, you're going to catch it. If you're in a hole, it's going to go over your head. That's how it worked.
Were there any casualties on your base?
Oh, yeah. Sure, we had casualties, yeah.
I'm just asking because you're making this sound like this is no big deal. But most of the people you're going to run into on the street have never been bombed before.
It was a big deal. You know, you're a kid. See, it's exciting, you know.
Uh-huh.
Not going to happen to me. It's going to happen to him. It's exciting. What was really the impact was when your pilot didn't come back. That was a hard swallow when your pilot didn't come back, and some of them didn't come back. We lost P-51s, we lost P-47s, and that was hard to take.
So did that mean you couldn't get too close to those guys, or did you still start to form
you
those
really
friendships?
Didn't make any difference. You formed some friendships. You know, this was Air Force, okay? Air Force was not rank crazy. Army was rank crazy. We were not rank crazy. They were lieutenants. They were captains. We didn't care. They didn't care. We were privates. I was a private, then I was a PFC, you know, one stripe, two stripe. They were friends. We were all in the same job. It wasn't like the military where you're marching. We didn't do any marching. We were fixing airplanes and flying airplanes. And the difference is magnitude, tremendous. I've talked to my Army friends today, and I can't believe what some of the stuff they go through in the Army. We never did that. We didn't have reveille. We didn't have formations. We just went to work.
Yeah.
And that was the way it was. It was an 8-hour day or a 15-hour day. That was the way it was. So those guys were our friends, and they knew what we were doing. We knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when you say when a pilot doesn't come back, sometimes that means he was shot down and killed. Other times that means he was shot down, bailed out, was taken prisoner, maybe even escaped through the underground. Is there one of those stories that you remember that really did affect you, or someone that you remember and say, yeah, that guy was a real hero to me?
Not really, because that's 70 years ago, and you forget a lot of this stuff. Some of the highlights you remember, but the things that you try not to remember, you don't. And when we lost somebody, that was a hard pill to take. I don't remember any of the names.
And I imagine, too, even though your job was the spark plugs when you got there, you probably saw some pretty significant evidence to the beating some of those fighter planes took.
Oh, yeah. Some of them were all shot up. Some of them were lucky, come back without a scrape, but there were a lot of bullet holes here and there. Some of them had bullet holes in the engine compartment where it would knock out a cylinder. The Pratt & Whitney was a remarkable engine. It would run back on half the cylinders. It was an amazing engine.
Now you sound like one of those P-47 pilots trying to say that the Jug was better than the Mustang.
That's an argument you can talk about all day long. They really did different jobs. The Mustang was a fighter plane. The P-47 Jug was more or less a strafer. It had 8 Brownings, 4 in each wing, and on the way back from a mission, Doolittle told them, strafe the country. So they'd get down low and strafe towns and strafe railroad cars, and once in a while you strafe a train, and an ammunition car would blow up. And they did a lot of strafing. That was a very effective airplane.
And I am just guessing, if you enlist at 17 and within months you're overseas and you're around all these gorgeous airplanes with these great capabilities, that you might have at least daydreamed of getting a ride in one of those, getting up in the air in one of those.
Oh, yeah. Never did till much, much later. Much, much later. Got a ride in the B-17 once, got a ride in the T-6. I had a ride scheduled in a P-51 about 2 years ago, and the guy had maintenance problems and didn't show up, so I didn't get a ride. I've never been in a P-51 yet. I will be.
Well, maybe we can fix that for you. There are a couple around here yet.
I'll tell you a quick story if you got more time. Iris Critchell, a WASP in World War II, dear friend of mine for like 45 years. About a month ago, she and a couple of her girlfriends went out to Chino Airport and wandering around, and a guy was pushing his P-51 out of the hangar. So they stopped, talked to him. And after a while, he began to hear things, and he says, did you fly? Sure. She's 97. Did you fly? Sure. And after about maybe another 10 or 15 minutes, he began to say, did you fly these? Yeah, I flew these. He was stunned. He had no idea. Iris Critchell flew P-51s out of Long Beach 197 times back to New Jersey, had about 21 girls working for her. 97, still spryer than I am. I saw her 2 weeks ago, still spryer than I am. Still very lucid, can address the whole group with confidence, and it's an amazing person. I hope I can live to be 97 and be like she is.
I think we all would, and maybe we'll have the privilege of catching up with her one of these days on Hometown Heroes. I've heard a lot about her, an Olympic swimmer in Berlin in 1936. A trailblazing pilot in World War II, and with her husband, a great impact on aviation ever since. I hope we have that privilege someday, and I'm thankful we get to hear John Durant's story today. We'll hear how he experienced the Berlin airlift from start to finish when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.